We're going to do start off with a little bit of about the book of Ezekiel. So I'm going to ask Mom to read an introduction. That's from a book called The Lion's Guide to the Bible.
What about the stuff that's underlined?
You're going to go ahead and read the whole thing.
The book of Ezekiel was composed entirely in exile. Ezekiel himself came from a priestly family and must have been one of the first deportees taken to Babylon after Nebuchadnezzar's attack in 597 BC. His prophetic ministry thus overlaps with Jeremiah's ministry. And despite being so far apart geographically, they are fully agreed. Yahweh's judgment will be followed by his active involvement to restore them. Even so, Ezekiel's prophecies have a slightly different feel. Being so many miles from his home, many of his prophecies are ecstatic visions as he is transported in visions of Yahweh to Jerusalem. And all his prophecies are deeply colored by his profound vision, described at the outset of Yahweh's glory and presence. Prophecies of Judgment, from 593 to 587 B.C. The book of Ezekiel begins with this awe-inspiring vision of Yahweh's glory. In the fifth year since the start of the exile in 592 B.C., Ezekiel sees what looks like four living creatures with an array of faces and wings and wheels, and above them is a throne on which is seated a figure like that of a man, blazing with light and rainbow colors. This was the appearance, writes Ezekiel, in differential terms, of the likeness of the glory of the Lord. Ezekiel falls face down, but is called to his feet and is touched by Yahweh's Spirit and is commissioned to prophesy fearlessly to the rebellious house of Israel. For 7 days he sits among the exiles, completely overwhelmed. Then, having had a repeat vision of Yahweh's glory, he is given some bizarre instructions. He is to lie on his side for over a year, 430 days, in order to symbolize Yahweh's judgment for 430 years on the kingdoms of Israel and Judah. These and other symbolic actions, some quite shocking, are all a dramatic way of portraying the sword, famine, and plague, which will be experienced by Jerusalem because of its rebellion. Only a small remnant will survive and eventually return. Even Yahweh's treasured place, the temple, will be desecrated by evil foreigners. Then they will know that I am the Lord. This last phrase will be repeated often in Ezekiel's later prophecies, indicating Yahweh's chief purpose in these momentous events. 1 year later, Ezekiel has another vision. That same figure like that of a man takes him in the spirit to the temple in Jerusalem and shows him what's going on. Priests reveling in their idols, others worshiping the sun god, and some women mourning for the goddess Tammuz. Moreover, the city is full of injustice and the land full of bloodshed. Yahweh issues a decree of death upon all in the city, apart from those who are grieved by these detestable things, and who are therefore marked on the forehead by a man clothed in linen. Meanwhile, Ezekiel sees the four living creatures whom he now recognizes to be the cherubim. They leave the temple and come to the mountain east of the city, the Mount of Olives. Yahweh's glory has made a dramatic exit. The city, thus abandoned by Yahweh, is now ripe for judgment. The glory of Yahweh's presence, known in Hebrew as Shekinah, has departed. But will it ever return? There then follow some more symbolic actions.
And he's just getting to read an author that's not ashamed or embarrassed of Yahweh's name. So here's a guy who studies it. He's not ashamed and embarrassed of his God's name, which is neat. But a little history. But what he saw is the conclusion of the introduction is Yahweh departing Jerusalem. And actually, if you can Google it, say, it'll say the Lord. When did the Lord depart from Jerusalem? And it's actually between like four different chapters, I think, in Ezekiel. But everybody's like, yeah, they know when it was. So Ezekiel witnessed what was going to happen. Now here's a little history. If you guys scoot over a little bit, you'll be able to see my props. I don't have enough ink in my cartridge to do as many as Granddad. Maybe next year if I get that big bonus. Okay. Thanks for laughing. Okay, what we have down here, I'm trying to read upside down. We have Jerusalem's down here. Okay. Right above is Samaria. I guess, did you get to zoom in?
Yeah.
Okay. What we have here is originally with David, the tribes were united and with him as a king. After David was Solomon. After Solomon was... anyone?
Rehoboam.
Rehoboam rebels, and Yahweh takes 10 of the tribes with Jeroboam north. So now Yahweh's people are divided into two different kingdoms. One is called Israel, and the other one's usually called Judah. And Judah had Levi, Benjamin, and Judah. Is that right, I think?
Benjamin.
I don't know if
Judah.
Okay. And then the Levites would have still been there, but... anyways, so there's two different kingdoms. Now, shortly after the northern tribe gets ripped away, they go right into rebellion. Start worshiping other gods. Why would you worship another god? John Shane and I did a real good teaching. He goes, why would people have so many gods, the Greeks or the Romans? Well, he goes, well, here's what you do. Okay, so you like war? Here, I got a Greek god of war right here. Here's Mars. Here, buy this, and then you can justify all your behavior because this is your god. Oh! Then she goes, I don't like war, but I sure like wine. Hey, we got one right here, Dionysus. Now you can justify all your behavior. You're just worshiping Dionysus. Well, how about you? Then there's all these guys that's going to justify the lust of the flesh, the lust of the eyes. Same way with witchcraft too. If you go into East Africa or these other places, why would you go to a witch? Because they're going to give you something. They're going to give you power. The same way we go to our government. But anyways, so what happened was, this is the same time as Jeremiah. Besides that, who else is the same time as Jeremiah? Another book in the Bible. Daniel. So you have Daniel, Jeremiah, and Ezekiel all around the same times. Now Jeremiah, man, you want to know about his life? You can just watch the movie Jeremiah.
Yeah.
He's got some big rewards. And he's living in Jerusalem. Now, up here, Jerusalem hasn't been judged yet. But Israel has, and what happened to them? They got taken away into captivity by first the Assyrians, and which is nice about right here. You can see Babylon's all the way down here, and you see this big white spot right here.
Yeah.
And I always wondered about that, but it was one of Dad's teaching. You got to point that out. This is a desert that you cannot cross. So if you watch all the migrations, always going to go up and over this thing like there's a gigantic mountain. And what it is a sea of desert. So you can see. So Babylon's not that far this way, but that's not the way you would have gone. So what happened was up here, Israel is carried away into the Syrians, who's in the captivities. Well, this guy, Peter, believes that Ezekiel, I forgot how to say his name correctly, was one of the first. And then Daniel's also in Babylon somewhere too. So it doesn't necessarily mean he's in Babylon, but he's in the vicinity. And so Daniel's here. And what Peter also points out is, Jeremiah is a compound word with Yahweh. Where does Jeremiah live? Jerusalem. These other two guys are living in captivity, and Daniel, the only time the word Yahweh is ever mentioned in the book of Daniel is when Jeremiah writes them. That's just, it's just like Christians today. We're living in a captivity. You don't even know the name of your God. Yeah. It doesn't mean that they don't know Him and through the different manifestations. Somebody on a desert island could love Yahweh. But they don't know his name. But Daniel didn't necessarily have it either. But here's Daniel's over here, and here's Ezekiel. And a very interesting thing about Ezekiel is, who is Jeremiah ministering to? I mean, he's ministering for Yahweh, but who is he prophesying to? Jerusalem. That's where he lives. Where does Ezekiel live? As far as we know, he's all the way over here. And who is he prophesying against? Jerusalem. Well, isn't that neat? Here he is, this place. You can imagine, here's Jeremiah going, I'm the only one. Yeah, I had a couple other ones. And here's Ezekiel. And Jeremiah goes, man, if people just see what I'm going through. And Ezekiel is going to get to see it. He does see it. And here he is, and he's telling them, you guys did not learn the lesson of your sister who was taken away in harlotry, which is Israel. The same thing is going to happen to you guys. But anyways, that's kind of a neat story about Ezekiel. And he's seeing a vision of what's going to happen. He gets to look back. Yahweh take another really cool thing about Ezekiel. Okay, who was carried away in a chariot of fire?
Elijah.
Elijah is carried away in a chariot of fire, right? Mm-hmm. It seems really unique, right? Until you read about Philip. Wait. Philip was carried away. Who else was carried away? Well, then there's another one where Paul says, I know a man, whether it's in the spirit or out of the spirit, he got carried away into some sort of vision. Ezekiel got the same thing. So here's these visions that are they possibly being teleported or whatever? So even what happened to Elijah is not that uncommon. It's happened to Ezekiel too. So Ezekiel's seeing what's going on. Here's the temple full of all these religious people, and inside's probably like our very evil Pope right now. He does not represent Yahweh. Here they are doing horrible things. And I think at one point in the book, Ezekiel looks through a wall, and Yahweh goes, look what they're doing. And they're worshiping the sun gods and these other things. Here is Ezekiel. But how, you know, it's amazing. You know, I'm picking on Israel and Judah. I do the same thing. How many of us in here know that Yahweh and Jesus Christ can read our mind? Oh, it's like a speakerphone. Nobody saw that, right? Yeah, they saw it. But all of us have a tendency, especially with sin and vice. But here's Ezekiel going, turn. And the neat thing is that the first part is he's seeing this wickedness. And the last part of Ezekiel is talking about these things being restored. And one of them is going to be the Dead Sea is going to be full of fish. Isn't that neat? Yahweh's going to heal all these things. And he talks about David is going to come and rule. And here's Ezekiel's getting to see these things. But here's a little bit easier picture showing, which you can see the water. This is water over here. So Jerusalem, right around here. Samaria, right around here also. Nineveh's all the way over here. Poor Jonah had to walk that.
Yeah.
Jonah get spit up on the beach here. Here we go. Walk all the way to Nineveh. Wait, but anyways, you get to see the distance. Here's Babylon, modern day Iraq, and they got Iran. But you get to see some of the history of what this guy's doing. But what really got me with reading just the introduction was Yahweh departs Jerusalem. And he gets to see Yahweh leave Jerusalem. And he's gone. And now we turn to Judges 278, page 278, Judges 16. That's kind of a neat pen I'm going to show Tim. This is, I got wood from Normandy, or I think it's Normandy, or Omaha Beach, from Wall Builders. Kind of cool.
Yeah.
As long as we're talking about history.
Very cool.
Okay, would somebody read the 16th chapter of Judges? I'll give you the verses here in just a second. But think about it. Isn't that neat? He's just going over. Here's Daniel. He's going to go through the Assyrians and then the Babylonians and then the Medes and the Persians. And Ezekiel's sticking up for Yahweh at the same time. Here's Jeremiah going through all kinds of stuff. And here at the same time, they're all fighting. You know, they need, I wonder how many other fellowships are just like us saying, I'm not ashamed anymore. No, just give me the truth.
Yeah.
I mean, so I think about it, even now, you know, even as we're praying, I have a tendency to think that as far as we know, we're the most accurate fellowship and Bible study on the planet. But it could be that we're living in captivity and there's some places in Jerusalem or in the area, they're going, yeah, we already know all these things. We don't know that, but I think about Daniel learning. Going, can you imagine Daniel the first time possibly reading Yahweh's name? I know him pretty good, you know. I know this Elohim really good. El is in my name, and here's Jeremiah writes about Yahweh, and here's Daniel going, could it be? That would have been the same way with Moses. Moses going, what's your name? The burning bush goes, Yahweh. You sure, Bush? Because I'm gonna look really silly if you're wrong. But anyways, okay, would somebody read 18 through 20?
And when Delilah saw
that... So we're reading about Samson. So Samson's finally going to go to the cave of Delilah. Why would he keep going back to a woman that's going to try to kill him? He's lonely. This happens with Christianity, too. Why do we compromise in our relationships? We get lonely. Why, when we get around other Christians, sometimes will we not even say Yahweh's name? I do it. And we would say, okay, we get embarrassed because we're possibly lonely. But here's Samson, a very lonely story. And here's the end. He's just so lonely that he goes back to Delilah and he tells her where his strength comes from. It's a covenant with his hair as a Nazarite. Okay?
When Delilah saw that he had told her all his heart, she sent and called to the lords of the Philistines, saying, come up this once, for he hath told me all his heart. And the lords of the Philistines came up unto her and brought up the silver in their hands. And she made him sleep upon her knees and called for a man and caused him to shave off the 7 braids of his head. And she began to humble him, and his strength departed from him. And she said, "The Philistines are upon thee, Samson." And he awoke out of his sleep and said, "I will go out now as time after time and shake myself free." He, not knowing that Yahweh had departed from him.
Right there, so John Shane has one of those pointed that out. He said, did Samson feel anything when he lost the spirit?
No.
Huh? Here's a lot of times people get saved. I didn't feel anything. There's feeling, it can come with it. Samson didn't know. He didn't know. How many times have we done the same thing where we sinned and we walked in a direction, in a room where we're supposed to go, and then everything's fine until something bad happens. Oh, where's my peace? You go, man. Samson didn't lose the Holy Spirit as soon as they jumped on him. He lost it as soon as he broke the covenant. As soon as they cut the hair, he was shaving the covenant. So with Israel, were they going to feel anything, or excuse me, Judah, when Yahweh's going to depart from Jerusalem? Were they going to see anything? No. It's the same way with us. You know, if you love me, keep my commandments. Why do you say you love me and don't do what I say? If we choose to go into darkness, we might feel something at first, but all of a sudden, I don't even feel anymore. And I got to see a neat teaching on Facebook. This guy's driving with his seatbelt alarm going off. And he goes, "Man, I hate this seatbelt alarm. It really reminds me of Izzy. Because one thing I do know about my seatbelt alarm, after 10 beeps, it goes off." And he goes, "But if I get into a wreck because I didn't put my seatbelt on, it's not the alarm's fault. It's not the car's fault. It's not the manufacturer's fault. It's my fault." He goes, "A lot of times Yahweh and Christ are sending us warnings. And they're just not going to keep doing it forever. It's just like that alarm. Eventually it will stop." But I thought it was a good way, even with Samson or any of us, if we're sinning or something like that, if we don't repent, then he's not going to keep sending things until we do a 180 and say, "Please come back." It's just like that. But here Samson loses the Holy Spirit. Horrible things happen to him. He loses his eyes. But he does repent and come make a comeback at the very end, which is really neat. And that's where we get the word, the reading here, and you heard somebody say, "Daggone it!" Well, that's the gods of the Philistines, Dagon. I think Samson invented that. So everything you say, "Daggone it!" You're like, "Oh, last time that's Philistine." Dagon's temple getting broke down. Anyways, dear judges, we turn to Exodus, page 116, right in that vicinity. Bet you didn't know that. Fish god.
What thing?
About 116, verse 32. So with Israel, what was Ezekiel witnessing? Yahweh departing. And what was he warning them? He goes, "It already happened to our people, you idiots. Didn't you learn anything? Didn't you see our hooks in our noses? Didn't you see us horrible rapes and pillages and everything, just humiliated?" And there's a talk in there that as they're being carried off, that their captors are saying, "Sing the song about Zion." And they go, and the righteous ones will go, "We can't sing about Zion. It's not in our heart." And there were righteous people that are carried away too. Obviously Ezekiel was, and here's Daniel. But they go, it's horrible. And he goes, "Didn't you guys learn anything by our rebellion?" But what are they doing? You know, sin is darkness, and we get blinder and blinder and blinder and blinder. Exodus chapter 32. Let me see. Verse 14. And actually, I'll go first, chapter, let's see, 31, verse 18. Kind of go over there, and I kind of skim through for a little bit. Yahweh has just delivered Israel from the Egyptians, from captivity, he's getting shown how strong and powerful he is. And then they're in their wilderness, and Yahweh calls up Moses to Mount Sinai. How many days was he up there? 40 days. What's 40? A number 4?
Probation.
Probation. Who's on probation? Moses?
No.
No. It's the Israelites. What's going to happen when... I think about that when mom and dad would go out of town when we were in high school. What are you going to do? You got 24 hours. Oh, boy. But Yahweh's going, "We're going to see what these guys are going to do without Moses." So he goes up there, and let me see here. In verse 18... it says, "Then gave he unto Moses, as he finished speaking with him in Mount Sinai, the 2 tables of the testimony, tables of stone written by the finger of Elohim." Here's Moses gets out there, he gets to see the 2 tables, and it's actually written, we're going to read it here, is on the front and the back. Right after that, the 2 tables, are carved out. Do you know what those two tablets really were? Yahweh carving out a wedding ring for his people. Mm-hmm. Can you imagine somebody going and here, and we're not just going to do a ring. I'm going to go carve something out for my people. And a wedding ring just represents a covenant. That's all it means. And after, not soon after Moses dusts off the, whatever's left on the, what would be little chips from the granite, he starts coming down, and this is when Aaron falls, and the people come and they say, we don't know about Moses. Make to us a god. And here, what happened was, in verse 7, a lot of them failed the probation. Then spake Yahweh to Moses, get ye down, for thy people whom thou hast brought up out of the land of Egypt have corrupted themselves. They have turned aside quickly out of the way in which I commanded them. They have made for themselves a molten calf and bowed themselves thereon and sacrificed thereon and have said, these are our Elohims, O Israel, who have brought thee up out of the land of Israel, Egypt. A child here. What are the 10 words? Exodus 20, 1 through 17. I'll give you $1 if you get them right. So into the camera, nice and loud.
The whole verse?
Yeah.
I, Yahweh, thy God, thou shalt not make the image, thou shalt not utter the name of Yahweh thy God for falsehood. Remember the Sabbath day on thy father and thy mother. Thou shalt not commit adultery, thou shalt not steal, thou shalt not commit
bear falsehood,
thou shalt not commit murder. No. Thou shalt not covet thy neighbor's goods.
Covet thy neighbor's goods. That's a real problem we have today in our society, right? We're going to take from somebody else and give to somebody. But by the time, and what does Yahweh tell Moses? Thou shalt not have any of the Elohim before me. They have a golden calf. Mm-hmm. Thou shalt not make an image. They have an image. Then he's going to go on. We're going to find they're doing a lot of other things too. They've broken almost most of the 10 words of the 10 commandments. Mm-hmm. Moses comes down. Can you imagine Moses? Mm-hmm. What? Man, how long have I been gone? You. As we get over to verse 32, verse 14. How about Ishaya? Why don't you read that, Isaiah?
Verse 14.
Yeah, 14. And I'll tell you when to stop.
So then I was grieved over the calamity. He has spoken and inflicted his people. And Moses turned and went down out of the mount with his two tablets of testimony in his hand, tablets written upon on both sides of them, on this and on that were they written. Now as for the tables, the work of Yahweh, they were. And as for the writing of Yahweh was graved upon the tablets. And Jehoshua heard the noise of the people, and they shouted and said to Moses, the noise of war is in the camp. But he said, not the noise of the cry of hear some noise, yet the noise of cry defeat, the noise of alternate song do I hear. And it came to pass, when he drew near to the camp, and saw the calf, and dancing, that the anger of Moses kindled, and he cast out his hands at the tables, and breaked them into pieces at the foot of the mountain.
Now this was, it wasn't until Dad did the teaching. It was, why did Moses break the Ten Commandments? The covenant was already broken.
Yeah.
Those pieces of rocks meant nothing. Mm-hmm. What if Isaiah gets to meet his wife, and Yahweh arranges it. People still have freedom of will. And Isaiah goes, and you mine your own diamond, like Minecraft, and then you make your own wedding ring. The wedding ring is not a gift to her, it's a symbol of your guys' covenant. Where in the Bible does it say death till death do us part? It doesn't. It's not biblical. But here's your covenant, and before you get to even see her, she's fornicating with somebody else. What would you do with that diamond? It would be repulsive. It would remind you of a horrible thing. You're gonna go, and that's what Israel did to Yahweh. And Moses intercedes in between to stop Yahweh, to try to find out, wiping them out, and Yahweh was grieved. But can you imagine somebody committing adultery before the wedding? Mm-hmm. Before the wedding? Yeah. And somebody goes, they messed up. What happens right after is Moses breaks it, and he goes, gird everybody your sword, in verse 27, and all these people that are doing this, go kill them. And 3,000 people died. If those 3,000 people did not die, who was going to die? All of them. Remember Achan? Sin is in the camp. You cannot go before your enemies. So that's with all of us in our household. If there's sin in the house, we got to get rid of it. We've got to confront this thing. So we can't have it. But here, 3,000 people die here. And then you get to read, okay, keep reading verse 32. Here's all 33. Moses goes back up. Who's feeling sorry for Moses? Man, my feet are killing me.
Yeah.
He goes back up, and then we get over to chapter 34. How many verses are between what we just read? It was 19? Yeah, that's 32, 19, all of that, to 33. And then to 34, what happens in 34? Chapter 34, verse 1, and Yahweh said to Moses, hew two stones. He goes into another covenant. But when those people were fornicating and doing this horrible thing that they were doing, did they think Yahweh could see? No, the prophet's gone! He can't see what we're doing. But Yahweh had already departed before Moses even came down. But that, with those 10 commandments, what would they mean to Moses? The ones that he broke? He probably would never want to see them ever again. Would he? Would you want to see that? No, that's horrible. I mean, if somebody did that to Isaiah, that would disgust me. That would break my heart. But if you did it to Yahweh, after he's just done all that, go, golly, that is disgusting. Those tablets are adulterous. It reminds me of something horrible, like Sodom and Gomorrah. That's Exodus. Another one, Yahweh departing. Boom. Why did Yahweh depart Samson? His choices and his behavior. Who chose? Adam and Eve. Their choices and their behavior. They chose, and it says Yahweh departing, but what it really is people turning their back on Yahweh. Yahweh is light, and in him is no darkness. And he can't go around darkness. And so when we have darkness in our life, he's going, hey, I can't come in until you get rid of that. You can imagine, you can imagine if you have a dog in your house and you want to have fellowship with a cat outside. The cat's not coming in. You got to get rid of the dog. 1 Samuel, page 292. And you get to read throughout Yahweh's word about people going through cycles. All of us do it, including me. We go through cycles, and all of a sudden I'm back down in a bad habit again. How'd that happen? You read through people, all of a sudden you're back down in a cycle, and they're going to go, okay, the objective is to learn from these things and help other people out. Go, hey, you got to get rid of that. I know you've tried to get rid of that, and you haven't, but you don't forget you got something you need to do. And that's what somebody that loves you will do. So you got to work on this thing, and we'll help them. Otherwise, they get really bad. 1 Samuel chapter 3. We're going to go into Samuel 2:92. And before chapter 4, the beginning of Samuel's of ministry, Yahweh wakes him up. And he goes, okay, and why is he going to talk to Yahweh? Because his stepdad, in my opinion, he was adopted by Eli. He's going to be his new father. He goes, Yahweh wants to talk to you. Go in there and go listen to him. He goes in there, speak, for your servant is listening. Here's somebody, maybe a little older, Ruth, maybe your guy's age. And he goes, you go tell your stepdad that what I'm getting ready to do to him is going to make everybody's ears tingle. What? What have I got to tell him? Then he goes, why? Because you have not confronted your two sons. And here's what his two sons are doing. Who noticed that he was not confronting his two sons? Yahweh did. And I was wrong on Eli for a long time. My dad straightened that out and showing, look, Eli did raise Samuel. And Samuel was a great prophet in the last judge. But in that one thing, Yahweh told him what was going to happen. You're going to die. All your seed's going to die. And Eli could have done what Nineveh did, right? Mm-hmm. He could have repented. He said, I'll do whatever it takes. Let's have a family meeting. But he didn't, you know, not to pick on him, but for us also. But in this case, Samuel tells him what's going to happen. So was Yahweh in Israel, or in Israel here? Or I guess it would be Judah. Is he dwelling amongst them? Not necessarily. He's got like one ambassador, like he did with Jeremiah in Jerusalem. And where is it? Because here we'll find out in chapter 4, what is that, 1 through 3. And so, well, would somebody read that for me?
I will.
Thanks.
And so it was when the word of Samuel had reached all Israel, that Israel went forth to meet the Philistines in battle. They encamped near
Ebenezer?
Ebenezer, where the Philistines encamped in
Aphek.
The Philistines set themselves in a way to meet Israel. And the battle spread, that then was Israel smitten before the Philistines. They were slain of the army in the field by 4,000 men. And when the people came into the camp of the elders...
We can stop there for a second. And this really speaks to me. Do you know when I... It is absolutely crystal clear when I have broken fellowship with Yahweh, when I get into a fight and I get whooped. Have you ever had that? Oh, everything's fine, everything's fine. All of a sudden you get 15 bills in ones. What? See, if we have Yahweh with us, if we have fellowship with Him, then it doesn't matter what we go through. He's got our hand, right? It's just like a little kid grabs their mom's shirt. Yeah. As long as she's there, that's fine. But how many times, like Samson or even Israel, have I not realized that I have broken fellowship until something really bad happens? And then guess what happens? My enemy?
Yeah.
What does he do? Does he turn to defend me? He goes, no, what did you do? What did you think was going to happen? I'm like, hey, wait a minute, you talked me into this. Your old man would just start accusing you, going, oh, you're going to get it. You're never going to get out of this one. You guys ever had that? Those thoughts of dread? What's happening to Israel? They go in to fight the Philistines. They get completely whooped. If you go back to verse 3, we'll find out how many people are going to die. Well, actually, I think we just did. But go, yeah, 4,000 people die. That's a tough lesson. Verse 3.
And when the people came to the camp, the elder of Israel said, wherefore hath Yahweh smitten us?
Who has smitten them?
Yahweh.
Why has Yahweh done this to us? Why has God given my child cancer? Why does he take my daughter from me? Well, they're in a better place. He works in mysterious ways. Doctrines today are just like the Philistines then. Who do they blame for these 4,000 people dying?
Yeah.
Well, it's Yahweh. God's in control. You're going to say, boy, man, how distasteful is that going to be? And they will be judged, especially the leaders. You're going to say, why did that happen? Well, you know why that's going to happen. What they do, they first blame Yahweh. And they say, wherefore has Yahweh smitten us today before the Philistines that only let us fetch?
So they said, before the Philistines, let us fetch out of Silah the ark of the covenant of Yahweh, that when it cometh into our midst, it may save us out of the hand of our enemies.
So what they're going to do is, Yahweh didn't go with us into battle, so we're going to go kidnap him and his ark, because there's a cherubim, and he's supposed to be in between them, right? We're going to go get him. If he doesn't want to come, we're going to bring him. How do you think that's going to work out? It doesn't work out. It doesn't work out at all, and they get smitten, they get whooped, they get horrible things happen. I think later on it says 30,000 people end up dying. Yeah, in verse 10. Eli's sons die, both of them die. Eli's grandson dies, Eli dies. What were they thinking? And then what was funny is that they thought that box represented Yahweh and his covenant with them. They broke the covenant. That box doesn't mean squat. Here they are. It was interesting. It said, when it cometh in our midst, it may save us. Here's the ark's going to save us. And we're going to see this over and over again with people worshiping Jerusalem. And here's Jesus Christ talking about the temple. What were they worshiping? The temple. You hear what he said about this building? This is our building. You're going to say, but it's the same thing. Here's like a wedding ring. I think of a...
It's a tablet.
A wedding ring where here's a husband and a wife. And here's a righteous... I mean, you could flip this either way. You get a bad husband or a bad wife. But in this case, I'll just say a husband is the righteous pastor. And the wife... Maybe it was ordained. Maybe Yahweh said to marry. But then the wife goes off and fornicates. Burns the house down. Does whatever. Gets boyfriends. And the husband finds out. She doesn't know he found out, but he saw it on Facebook. You saw her on the news, running around with people in front of everybody. What would that do to that husband? Yahweh's seeing all these things that people are doing. And then she comes back and he goes, you're right. She goes, we're married. What would that mean to him? He's going to say, that wedding ring doesn't mean anything. But this is what Israel does to Yahweh. We're married. We got the ark. We have Jerusalem. And the funny thing about this is that Yahweh was not dwelling between the cherubim at that point, because that ark represented a broken covenant, meant nothing. He was with Samuel, right? But it does appear that he does start dwelling amongst this box when it goes to the Philistines, because they get plagued everywhere. And they have more reverence than Israel, but it's a little irony. We think about an adulterous wedding ring, but people look and going, ha, what would that mean? I mean, golly, a wedding certificate about a husband who's abandoned the family, that's done horrible things, and now he's going to hold that certificate up, saying, you're in it with me. It's disgusting, isn't it? But that's what man keeps doing with Yahweh. And I wouldn't say that Samson did that. But for him to expect he's going to get away with it, I've done that. That wasn't nearly as bad as this, though. But we can look and say, even during Ezekiel's time, he's looking back and he's seeing Jerusalem, and what are they still worshiping? They think that they have the temple. We're going to be fine. And what does Ezekiel know about that temple? That temple represents adultery. That's not going to do you any good. They got besieged, but there was a king named, I think it was Hezekiah. What did Hezekiah do? He goes before Yahweh. Okay, there's, I think it was Hezekiah, wasn't it? And guess what? Israel gets carried away, and they survive, but then they regress. They go right back into the gutter. And we look at Harvard University, Yale, and these Ivy schools. Do you know what they were originally started off as? Christian schools. What are they now? They're anti-Christ. And now we look at even the city of Jerusalem, and here's Christians have this affection to go back to an image that represents adultery. What is Jerusalem? It's adultery. It doesn't mean anything to Yahweh. You're going to say, how could you say that about Jerusalem? You mean the ones that murdered his son? Or they, and that recently pointed that out. Killed Stephen? Killed James? Tried to kill Peter? Tried to kill Paul, and as far as we know, they did stone Paul, and he died because they drug him away. I believe that he might have been possibly resurrected. How does Yahweh feel about that city? It's going to go. But in that interesting, I remember even growing up, there was a show that came on. They said that they had found the Ark of the Covenant. There's this whole show; they're going to find it. We went to a Bible study, and I didn't even know what the Ark of the Covenant was, but I knew everybody was really excited. So, oh, okay, we got to find this Ark of the Covenant, and. But I went back to talk to my dad about it. My dad goes, it means nothing. He goes, people are always looking for an image to worship. Can you make an image of Yahweh?
No.
No. People have a real problem with that. So give me some sort of image to worship. Now it's going to be the Ark of the Covenant. What happened when they made a serpent? They put it on a bronze. What do they do with that? Later on, they end up worshiping. How about, what was his name? Gideon? He makes an ephod. What do they end up doing with that? They end up worshiping with these images. Turn to 1 John, page 246. We can look and say there are deceived people, and knowledge puffs up, but charity edifies. So when we get knowledge and we get these things, the idea is to help people. There are people that really think that the Christians are obligated to help Israel. And we got to go, you don't know what you're talking about. And you say, well, Jerusalem, Jerusalem, Israel, Israel, here are these other things. And you say, Matthew 4:6. Everybody say Matthew 4:6. Matthew 4:6. It's easy to remember because 4'6" is about the height of a girl, right? And you can say Matthew 4:6. Satan misquoted Psalms 91, trying to get Jesus Christ to commit a suicide. He misquoted scriptures. Do you guys remember that? If you are the son of Yahweh, cast yourself down. Did Satan or the adversary quote scriptures? Yeah. And what did Jesus Christ say? It is also written. And so that's where we got to remember that. Even when people take things out of context, whether it's Israel, absent from the body, present with the Lord, you say, it is also written, just like Christ did. 2:22. Who would like to read that for me, please?
I will. Who is the false word? Say Pete that thinketh that Jesus is the Christ. The same is the Antichrist.
Okay, so you just read that. So what? How old are you?
Eight.
You're eight. What does that scripture say? Who is Antichrist? Anyone who denies Jesus Christ as the Mashiach is Antichrist. Jerusalem right now is an Antichrist. Do you know you can't preach about the word in Jerusalem? Christians can be there, but you can't say anything about this. You're going to say that whole area right there, you're going to say it's a symbol of adultery. It's just a whole other image. But what about Jews? Quote, remember in Revelation, Jesus Christ, Yahweh through Christ says, for those who call themselves Jews, says in the book of Revelation. Did you know that? They go, we're Jews. Yeah, who is the seed of Abraham? It's got two thumbs, and it's attached to your hands. There you go. You. Galatians says, we're the seed of Abraham. And they go, no, we're the seed of Abraham. Yeah, we read about that in Revelation too. Yeah, the so-called Jews. Anybody who denies the Mashiach is Antichrist. You are Antichrist. I don't like the sound of that. Would you like to cross over? No, okay, stay away from me then. Now we turn to 1 John 1:5. Now this is kind of looking at the idolatry of the building of Jerusalem and the walls, the idolatry of the Ten Commandments that it turned into, the idolatry of even the staff with the serpents, then the ephod of Gideon, all these idolatries. Now I can turn something back onto me now. So I can dish it. I like that saying. I know you can dish it. Can you take it? You know, somebody's... but you want to say 1 John 1:5. And this is a message which we have heard from him and are reporting unto you, that Yahweh is light and in him is no darkness at all. Those people that are doing those horrible things inside of his temple, was there any light in there? No. You cannot have fornication, lust of the flesh, and have light. You get one or the other. If we say we have fellowship with him and are in darkness or walking, we are dealing falsely and not doing the truth. Whereas if in the light, you know, I've been there. You know what? I've been there. I thought I had fellowship with Jesus Christ and Yahweh, and then I got beat up like Samson did. And then all of a sudden, I'm like, here they go, all the come to Jesus moment. This wasn't me. You're in the back of a patrol car. Okay, I'm ready to talk. Are you still there? Or you say, liar, liar. He can't stop lying. He goes, what's happening to me? The hands, he's trying to write the pins blue. And then all of a sudden, he starts going, you're reaping what you sow. And all of a sudden, he starts coming back out. You're going to go, yeah, you're reaping. I always thought that was funny. All of us have been there. Whereas if in the light we are walking, as he is in the light, we have fellowship one with another, and the blood of Yehoshua, his son, is cleansing us from all sin. If we say sin, have we none? Does Israel say, you know, here, well, just thinking about them murdering Jesus Christ and saying he's not the Messiah. Can somebody say he's not the Messiah and not be in sin? You reject, yeah, you're in sin, especially if you know better. We are deceiving ourselves and the truth is not in us. If we are confessing our sins, faithful is he and righteous, that he should forgive us our sins and cleanse us from all unrighteousness. Now you say, we can look at Israel taking the Ark of the Covenant and going, you guys are a bunch of dummies, right? Right? You know, Sam was just warning you what was going to happen. You're doing all these wicked things, you're going to go to battle. How about Samson? You read about Samson and he finally cuts his hair and he thinks he's going to get away with it. Doesn't that look kind of like silly for us? Mm-hmm. I look at the Ark of the Covenant, or the temple, or any of these things. You go, those are symbols of idolatry, and of people that thought they could have the best of both worlds. I'm going to have both, mm-hmm. And those examples are all what Yahweh calls adultery. And adultery doesn't have to necessarily be a fornication. He called his people adulterous. Unconditional love is a doctrine of adultery. Why? Unconditional love When they say that it doesn't matter what you do or you don't do, there's nothing you can do to make them love you more or love you less. What does that doctrine teach the people to do? Go! Make a golden calf. It doesn't matter what you do. It's okay. No matter what you do or you don't do, He loves you. And then the person who said that, now Aaron dodged a lot of bullets, and I wouldn't recommend anybody to try to be like Aaron. I don't know how he dodged so many bullets, but he did. But if a preacher starts saying that, and these people start fornicating, and doing, it doesn't matter what you do or you don't do, when 1 John says, if you are in darkness, and you think you have fellowship, you're a liar. Then usually what's going to happen when you preach that doctrine, why would anybody want that? Because that doctrine tells people they can have both worlds. You can have a golden calf. You can covet your neighbor's goods. Or I remember the flesher's house. Hey, Jesus Christ doesn't care how I vote. Do you vote to covet your neighbor's goods? He didn't care about that. You are deceiving yourself. And so you say, but it comes back down to unconditional love is the same thing. Then we got to come back in and go, look, you guys are fooling yourself. But anyways, we'll close up with, we'll go back to, we look at, you know, you read about the carrying away and the exile, and you're going to go, holy moly, how in the world did Jerusalem not learn their lesson? You know, here's Israel's carried away with hooks in their nose. Where are they? Over here. Can you imagine Jeremiah? I mean, what if he got to talk to Daniel? He goes, Daniel sounds like a heathen. Why do you say that, Jeremiah? He doesn't even know Yahweh's name. How could Yahweh be talking to him, right? And here's this guy living over here. I mean, possibly. And then here's Jerusalem dodges a bullet with a Sennacherib, I believe it was. And Hezekiah falls down on his knees. They get spared. And then they go right back to it. And then we look at these fools done. They're carried away. And then what happens after that? They eventually get brought back. And then what happens? They look like a bunch of dummies. But then the idea is for all of us also to go, if we think that we can have the best of both worlds, the lust of the eyes and the lust of the flesh, and we can live with them. Now, all of us got to deal with it. You know, there's a neat thing I heard somebody teach. He said, Jesus Christ was tempted, was he not? Mm-hmm. Okay, so did he ever sin?
No.
Okay, so you can be tempted and not sin. Does that make sense? So if you have a thought flies through your head and you're tempted, it doesn't mean you sinned. You just say, like my dad said, he goes, you change the channel. Like, no garbage on this channel here. Turn that and say, the love of God, think of no evil, rebuke it. But you can't have the best of both worlds. And if you do, one of the things that always held me back was my relationships with my friends. And I would always, and my justification is, who's going to take care of them? That was my justification for years. Who's going to take care of them? And until finally Yahweh called, and one of the first times I ever heard it communicate so clearly, I was at Kansas State, laying in my bed. I'd listened to a teaching my dad sent up. Him and my mom bought me a tape player so I could listen to the tapes. How generous is that? They not only were paying for school tape player and listen to tapes, he was listening to John Lynn. And as I'm listening to John Lynn's teachings, my peace is there. And as soon as I get off, I turn it off, all of a sudden it goes, so what are you going to do, Aaron? I'm like, what do you mean, what am I going to do? He's what are you going to do? And I sat there, and I go, I don't know what to do. And here I'm sitting in my bed, and I go, what do I do? And a peaceful breeze comes through, and he says, go home. I go, go home? I had this peace, perfect peace. It's so nice. And then I was like, wow. And then after about 15 seconds, my brain attacks you. You can't go home. You got a lease. You got all your friends here. You're going to be abandoning all your friends. I'm like, And then I went back down on my knees. I could speak. It was a Samuel moment. Were you speaking to me? Really? Go home. And you know what happened? I made a lot of enemies. Because I go, I got to go. And they're like, what? You can't go. I was like, well, we'll figure it out later. And I went home every weekend for the rest of the semester, not knowing what to do. But you know what happened? Those people that I thought needed me, guess what happened to one of them? Turned his whole life around. Here's J.D. Seamster said that Brian LePaul said Aaron flipped out. Aaron wigged out. And everybody, the rumors went through. Aaron went loco. He went nuts. You can imagine, that's a good way to sell some tabloids. And what happened was Yahweh, they were watching me. And actually, I was going to be able to help him, but it was going to be my exile. But anyways, it would be the same thing with you guys.